Did you know that most garden plants are basically doomed the exact moment we put them in the shopping cart?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it turns out that the whole emotional impulse buy at the local nursery is actually the number one cause of plant mortality.
It's tragic,
It
honestly.
really is. Anyway, welcome to the Pitcot Podcast. I am your host, Bill Pitcot, and I am absolutely thrilled to be here today.
And I am Annabelle Pitcot, so excited to be co-hosting this with you today. We've got an incredible deep dive for you today.
We really do. We are going to unpack the mechanics of turning that overwhelming, chaotic trip to the garden center into a foolproof, scientific, and honestly joyful process.
Right, because it should be joyful.
Exactly. And before we get into the roots of this topic, pun intended, all the information we're exploring today comes straight from the best-selling ebooks on our ebook store. You can visit www.pitcot.com/books to download them and follow along.
And while you're getting set up with that, please subscribe to our channel if you haven't. Activate the notification bell so you don't miss our new uploads. And don't forget to click on the stars below to give us a rating. We appreciate you giving us a 5-star rating to propel this podcast to help others too.
Yes, thank you for that. So our mission today is totally transforming the way you look at garden selection. We're parsing through the Pitcot source material to help you build a vibrant garden tailored perfectly to your unique space and lifestyle.
Whether you have, a massive suburban yard or just a sunny fire escape in the city, the science applies exactly the same way.
Which I love. Usually people think gardening is just like grabbing a pretty flower, digging a hole, and walking away.
Right, which is exactly why so many beginner gardeners end up so frustrated. I mean, we see this vibrant pink flower under the nursery lights, and we buy it based on pure aesthetic.
We've all done it.
Oh, for sure. But we're ignoring the biological reality of where that plant is actually going to live. So before you buy a single seed, the Pitcot guides emphasize what they call the 15 minutes of observation rule.
Which sounds so simple, but it's actually a diagnostic tool. You spend a full day monitoring the light in your specific yard.
Precisely. You need to know the difference between morning light and afternoon light.
Because they aren't the same.
Not at all. Morning sun is cool and gentle. It dries the overnight dew off the leaves, which actually prevents fungal diseases.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about the dew.
Yeah. Afternoon sun, however, is intense and baking. So if you take a delicate flower that thrives in gentle morning sun and you put it in a west-facing spot that gets hammered at 3 p.m.
It's just gonna fry.
Exactly. It will suffer severe heat stress and scorch.
Okay, so the light is one half of the equation, but the dirt itself is the other. The source material talks a lot about identifying your soil type, specifically the difference between sand and clay. Why does that dictate what we can actually grow?
Well, it comes down to microscopic structure and oxygen. Sandy soil is made of large, jagged particles. Water drains straight through it, taking all the nutrients with it.
So your plants dry out super fast.
Right. Clay soil, on the other hand, is made of microscopic, flat particles that stack tightly together, kind of like bricks.
Like actual clay.
Yeah. So when clay gets wet, it holds the water and basically squeezes out all the air pockets. Plant roots need oxygen just as much as they need water.
Wait, really? Oxygen in the dirt.
Yes. So in heavy clay, they literally drown and rot.
That is so wild.
Yeah.
So buying a sun-loving, drought-tolerant plant for a shady yard with heavy clay is like, buying a massive, sprawling sectional sofa without measuring your tiny living room.
That is a perfect analogy. The dimensions are just wrong from the start.
But knowing your yard's dimensions is only part of it, right? Because you also have to know your own lifestyle.
Yeah.
I mean, is it okay to actually want a high-maintenance garden? Or is low fuss always the ultimate goal for a beginner?
No, it is completely fine to want a high-maintenance garden, provided you're honest about your time commitment.
Right, the honesty part is key.
Exactly. High-maintenance plants require frequent interventions, pruning, feeding, staking them up against the wind. If you find joy and stress relief in that daily tinkering, it's highly rewarding.
But the danger is the mismatch.
Bingo! If you only have 15 minutes a week to spare, you need tough, low-fuss plants that essentially thrive on neglect.
Measure the living room, measure your time. I
Yeah.
love that. Okay, so once we have that baseline, we get into the great debate of what to plant. annuals versus perennials.
Ah, yes, the classic debate.
Right. But wait, if annuals are plants that die every single year, why on earth would I waste my money on them when perennials last for decades?
It's actually a brilliant biological trade-off. Annuals are the sprinters of the plan.
Sprinters?
Yeah. Their entire evolutionary purpose is to grow, flower, and set seed before the winter freeze kills them. Because they only have one season to reproduce, they pour every ounce of their energy into producing massive, bright, continuous blooms.
To attract pollinators immediately.
You got it.
So they give you that instant gratification. The ultimate beginner list for these sprinters includes marigolds, zinnias, cosmos, petunias, and sunflowers.
All fantastic choices.
Yeah, they're perfect for experimenting without a long-term commitment.
Yeah.
But how do we keep them blooming all summer if their goal is just to make seeds and die?
That brings us to a crucial mechanism called deadheading.
Which sounds intense.
It does, but it's simple. When an annual flower starts to wilt and fade, it's transitioning into a seed pod. If you snip that dying flower off, you interrupt the plant's reproductive cycle.
Oh, so you're tricking it.
Completely.
Yeah.
The plant essentially panics, realizes it hasn't produced seeds yet, and shoots out a brand new flower to try again. You're tricking its biology to keep your garden colorful.
That is beautifully manipulative. I love it. Okay, so those are the annuals. Perennials, on the other hand, play the long game.
Exactly. Perennials are the marathon runners. During their first year or two, they might not flower much at all.
Because they're busy underground.
Right. They are funneling all of their energy downward, building dense, complex root networks and storing carbohydrates. When winter comes, the top of the plant dies back, but that massive root system sleeps underground.
And then, boom, spring hits.
Spring hits, and it uses all that stored energy to burst back to life, getting bigger and stronger every single year.
The payoff plants, I've heard them called that. The beginner perennials to look for are coneflowers, black-eyed Susans, daylilies, hostas, and lavender.
Yes, and the pick-cop material makes a fascinating point here about foliage.
Oh, right, because we get so distracted by flowers. But plants like hostas, ferns, and ornamental grasses provide texture and structure through their leaves, even when literally nothing is blooming.
Exactly. The foliage provides the constant visual anchor.
I think my favorite way to visualize this is an analogy you hear a lot among landscape designers. Perennials are your furniture.
Yeah, the permanent structural backbone.
Right. And annuals are your throw pillows. They're the cheaper accents you swap out for quick pops of bright color. But why is mixing both the secret to a garden that never looks bare?
It's a strategy of time management. If you plant only perennials, your garden will look very sparse for the first 2 years while they establish those deep roots.
Oh, so you have these big, awkward gaps.
Exactly. By planting annuals in the empty gaps between them, you get explosive color right away. Eventually, your furniture matures and fills the space, and you just won't need as many throw pillows.
That makes so much sense. Okay, so we have our plants selected, but we have to actually get them into the dirt. And beginners often walk into a hardware store and feel incredibly intimidated by the walls of specialized gear.
Oh, it's so overwhelming. But it's a massive misconception that you need a shed full of expensive equipment. The guidelines are really clear on this. You only need four basic items to start.
Just four.
Just four. A sturdy trowel for digging, sharp pruners for deadheading, thick gloves to protect your hands, and a watering can. That is the entire essential toolkit.
Okay, I have to confess, I am guilty of something terrible here. I frequently leave my trowel and my pruners out in the rain for days.
Oh, no.
I know. But why is maintenance such a big deal if they're just meant to dig in the dirt anyway?
Because rust and dull edges actively harm your plants. A rusty trowel creates more friction, making you work twice as hard to dig.
Oh, so it's harder on me.
Right, but it's worse for the plants. Dull, rusty pruners don't slice cleanly through a stem. They crush it.
Yikes.
Yeah. That crushed tissue becomes an open wound that invites bacterial and fungal infections. Plus, unclean tools transfer soil-borne diseases from a sick plant directly to a healthy one.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
If you clean them, dry them before storing, and occasionally oil them, good tools last decades. Cheap, neglected ones last a single season.
So why do beginners always feel the compulsion to overcomplicate their tool shed, buying, like, $50 specialty weeding gadgets before they've even planted a seed?
It's human nature, really. We equate purchasing equipment with acquiring expertise. Buying gear feels productive. It feels like you're gardening without actually having to sweat or get your hands dirty.
So we basically buffer our anxiety with purchases.
We certainly do. And if you want a much better way to buffer your knowledge without buying unnecessary gadgets, you should visit www.pitcot.com. Subscribe to our channel if you haven't, and activate the notification bell so you don't miss our new uploads. Also, push the like button and rate us if you love our show. It helps in the recommendation algorithm so others can access it too. And don't forget to click on the stars below to give us a rating.
Yes, every rating helps us bring these insights to you. Okay, so we have our well-oiled tools and our plants. Now we have to actually arrange them. The Pitcot Guide treats garden layout like living artistry, focusing on contrast, texture, height, and time.
Right. Composition is what separates a collection of plants from an actual garden. You want to create contrast. Biologically, pairing a feathery, delicate flower, like a cosmos, next to a rigid structural plant, like a zinnia.
It highlights both of them.
Exactly. It highlights the unique geometry of both. Mixing bold colors with soft pastels works the same way.
And there's a specific rule about numbers that I found fascinating. We are advised to plant in odd numbers, like groups of three or five, never in pairs. Why does that matter?
It is deeply tied to how human visual processing works.
Really?
Yeah. When the brain sees an even number, like two or four plants grouped together, it easily divides them, categorizes them as a static symmetrical pair, and the eye just stops moving.
It gets bored.
Basically.
Yeah.
But when you plant in groups of three or five, the asymmetry forces the eye to keep moving around the arrangement, trying to find balance. It creates a natural, dynamic sense of flow.
That is so cool. You are literally tricking the eye. It reminds me of directing a theater play. If you put all your actors in a straight horizontal line at the front edge of the stage, the play is flat and boring. You need layers.
The layering rule is your vertical structure, yes. Tall plants, like your sunflowers, are your background actors. They go in the back so they don't block the light for the others.
Makes sense.
Medium perennials take the midground. Short, creeping borders go in the foreground. And to make that entire stage look cohesive, you repeat elements.
Like echoing colors.
Exactly. A cluster of yellow daylilies on the left side should be echoed by a splash of yellow marigolds on the right. It guides the viewer's eye across the whole space.
But unlike a play, a garden exists in the fourth dimension,
right?
Time. If you don't use succession planting, your garden will just explode with color in June and then look like a sad, empty green stage by August.
That's why succession planting is pacing. You need spring bulbs, like tulips, to open the show in April. As they fade, your summer perennials take over the second act in July. Finally, late bloomers like fall asters close out the show in October.
It's a continuous relay race.
I love that.
Now, a beautifully designed, well-layered garden isn't just for us humans to look at. It actually functions as a thriving micro-ecosystem.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's dig into climate zones, native plants, and pollinators. First, what exactly is a climate zone?
So, the USDA Hardiness Zone map is a scientific standard based on the average minimum winter temperatures in your specific region.
Okay.
For example, if you live in Zone 5, your winter temperatures regularly drop to minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. If you buy a beautiful perennial that is only rated for Zone 8, where winters are mild,
it won't survive.
Right. The cellular structure of that plant's roots will literally freeze, shatter, and die in your soil.
Which brings us to the ultimate shortcut, native plants. The Pitcot material frames native plants as a brilliant hack for lazy gardening.
It is the best hack.
Because these species evolved in your specific geographical area over thousands of years, right? So they already have the genetic programming to handle your local rainfall, your soil chemistry, and your temperature swings.
Yeah, by planting natives, you are effectively outsourcing your garden maintenance to Mother Nature. Because their root systems have evolved to dig incredibly deep to find local water tables, they require almost zero supplemental watering or synthetic fertilizer once established.
So they're basically on autopilot.
Completely on autopilot.
And when you plant natives, the local wildlife immediately recognizes them. Let's talk about pollinators, bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds.
The essential workers of the garden.
Exactly. The beginner favorites for attracting them are coneflowers, zinnias, marigolds, sunflowers, bee balm, butterfly bush, asters, and goldenrod. And we have to mention milkweed, which is biologically mandatory if you want monarch butterflies.
It really is. Milkweed is the sole food source for monarch caterpillars. The plant contains specific toxins that the caterpillars digest and store in their bodies, making them poisonous to predators like birds.
That's amazing.
Yeah, without milkweed to provide that chemical defense, the monarch life cycle completely collapses.
That is incredible. But if you're going to plant milkweed or bee balm, there's a specific method to it.
Yeah.
The clustering rule. You shouldn't just scatter one pollinator plant here and one over there.
Right. You have to think about how a bee or a butterfly sees the world from high in the air. If you plant a massive, dense cluster of purple salvia, say, 5 or 7 plants all touching each other, it creates a massive block of color.
Like a target.
Exactly. It acts like a neon runway light. It is exponentially easier for a tired traveling pollinator to spot a huge target than a single isolated flower.
A neon runway for bees. I love that visual. But let's pivot for a second. What if a listener is thinking, well, this all sounds amazing, but I live in an apartment. I don't have a yard for a runway of salvia. How do we overcome space limitations?
Container gardening is the great equalizer. It is perfect for balconies, renters, patios, or really anyone with physical limitations who can't comfortably kneel on the dirt.
Grad backs, for sure.
Exactly. But the physics of a container are very different from the earth. The absolute non-negotiable rule is drainage holes.
Because if a pot doesn't have a hole in the bottom, it's literally just a bathtub.
A muddy bathtub. Without drainage, the water pools at the bottom, displaces all the oxygen, and causes root rot. The soil choice is just as critical, too. The biggest beginner mistake is taking a shovel, digging up heavy garden soil, and dumping it right into a pot.
But wait, why does that kill the plant? I mean, if it's good enough for the ground, why not the pot?
Because the ground relies on earthworms, deep freeze-thaw cycles, and vast underground ecosystems to keep the soil aerated. When you trap garden soil in a plastic pot, it compacts into a dense brick.
Oh, and the roots suffocate.
Exactly. You must always use potting mix, which is specially formulated with ingredients like perlite.
Those are those little white volcanic rocks, right?
Yep. They ensure there are always tiny pockets of air for the roots to breathe.
That makes total sense. And flowers like petunias, marigolds, and zinnias thrive in those well-aerated pots. But what about common blunders?
Well, the common mistakes to dodge are exactly what you'd expect. Overwatering, planting seeds way too deep so they can't push through to the sunlight, ignoring sun requirements, and overcrowding.
Because we want it to look full and lush on day one.
Exactly. But they need room to grow.
What I love most about container gardening is that it acts as the ultimate undo button in landscaping.
It really does. It gives you complete environmental control. If you realize a plant is scorching in the afternoon sun, you simply pick up the pot and move it to the shade.
Which you definitely can't easily do once a plant is buried deep in a garden bed.
Not without a lot of sweat and stress for the plant.
Right. And to master all of this, whether in pots or in the ground, the Pitcock Guides highly recommend keeping a garden journal. Turning vague, fuzzy memories like, oh, I think those yellow flowers did okay by the fence, into actual, actionable data.
Yes, recording exactly what you planted, the soil type, and how the light hit it.
It seems like a lot of work, though.
It's a little bit of work up front, but data collection removes the guesswork for next year. It shows you your specific patterns.
So bringing all of these mechanisms together, what does this ultimately mean for you, the listener? The philosophy here is really about embracing the reality of gardening as an imperfect, deeply personal journey.
Right. It means we have to normalize failure as part of the process. Weeds will aggressively invade. Squirrels will dig up and eat your carefully planted bulbs.
They always do.
Always. And despite your best efforts with light and soil, some plants will just wilt. That is not a personal failure. It is just the reality of interacting with nature.
And you are allowed to break the aesthetic rules. Mix clashing colors if they bring you joy. Let your native plants grow a little wild.
Gardens that look like highly controlled, perfect golf courses often feel sterile.
Yeah, a little messiness, a little chaos. It makes the space feel vibrant and human. It's about being present for the tiny milestones, waiting patiently for the very first green shoot to break the soil, watching a monarch actually land on the runway you built for it, smelling the lavender you kept alive.
Which leaves us with a profound final thought. We live in an era that is intensely digital, fast-paced, and screen-dominated.
For sure.
The world often feels entirely chaotic and out of our control. But there is a well-documented psychological mechanism at play when we garden. Getting your hands physically in the dirt exposes you to soil microbes that actually trigger the release of serotonin in your brain.
Wait, really? Dirt literally makes us happier.
Biologically, yes. But beyond the chemistry, the simple tactile act of tending to a small patch of earth, planting a seed, it's an ultimate act of faith. You are trusting that if you provide the right environment, something beautiful will grow tomorrow. It physically changes our mental health, and it restores a tangible sense of hope in the future.
That is incredibly powerful. You step away from the digital noise, observe your environment, respect the biology of the plants, and build something that is beautifully, imperfectly yours.
Well said.
Thank you. I will leave a link in the description below. Please subscribe to our channel if you haven't and activate the notification bell so you don't miss our new uploads. Also, press the like button and rate us if you love our show. It helps in the recommendation algorithm so others can access it too. Thank you for being there with us, and don't forget to click on the stars below to give us a rating.